You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers. Each month, WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Bentz speaks with distinguished professor of atmospheric science Paul Rober as part of our Climate Conversation series. In this final installment of the series, they're joined by two policy experts. Amber Meyer-Smith is from the organization Clean Wisconsin, and she's a member of Governor Tony Evers' Climate Change Task Force. Shalonda Baker is a professor at Northeastern University School of Law in Boston. Before moving to Boston, Baker was a Hastie Fellow at UW-Madison. They join Bentz and Rober to discuss what needs to happen to get policy in place to curb climate change.
So, Shalonda, one thing that we've seen already with the pandemic and with past weather disasters like Hurricanes Maria and Katrina, we know, as you pointed out, that climate change is going to have a disproportionate effect on vulnerable populations. And that's both here in the U.S. and globally. Despite this, it's also true that just as with the pandemic, climate change ultimately affects everyone. And so it's not like anyone gets a free pass from any of this. And so this really should be seen as a problem for everyone to address, never mind your views on social or racial equity or just fairness in general. So how do you see that dynamic playing out in the policy realm? How do you convince people that this is something that everyone needs to care about?
You know, that is a really hard question. I think there is the moral argument, and that doesn't always carry the day. The backup argument is, well, our fates are inextricably intertwined. And we see that with COVID-19, right? Where we have certain folks who are on the front lines because they have to be, and they're so-called essential workers, but yet they've been expendable up until now. And so I think making the case that our fates are intertwined and that we are connected and that there is no separation between my fate and yours, and there's no separation between my suffering and yours, right? I think that's one way to do it. I also think, economically involving, there's an economic argument, right? Because that's ultimately where we usually end up with these sorts of things. I think there's a case to be made that if we have a strong base and we have folks who are, able to quote unquote bounce back after a major weather event or climate event, that makes us all better. That makes us all stronger, right? It's not as much of a drag on the overall economy. So for me, the moral argument is the first one that I make. The second is, our fates being linked. And we're seeing that in so many ways today with COVID-19. And then I think the third is, there really isn't a case for saying if all boats are lifted, then we're all, we're all better off in terms of the economic picture.
So Amber, you're the Vice President of Programs and Government Relations with Clean Wisconsin. One of the things you're tackling is being part of the governor's task force on climate, or climate task force. There's a lot to that, but I've been watching some of those meetings, and the points that Shalonda is making have become more and more pronounced in your proceedings, haven't they? It's been a really fascinating journey just to watch from the outside. So can you tell us where things stand basically with the task force and what the potential is, what could be achieved with these recommendations?
Last fall, Governor Evers actually issued an executive order, and he said, climate change matters to me as a governor, and it matters to our state for all the reasons that Shalonda articulated. We need to have a focus, and we need to bring people together to discuss what kind of solutions the state should be looking at. And I want to highlight, too, that was coming off of 8 years under Governor Walker, where he had climate change information scrubbed off of the DNR's website. He was not allowing state government to talk about climate change at all. We just have a real hole here in terms of where Wisconsin's at in trying to tackle climate change. So Lieutenant Governor Mandela Barnes chairs the task force, and I just appreciate so much his leadership in continuing to make sure that we are looking at how inclusive we're trying to be when we're soliciting ideas and solutions. Oh, and I should add that you can also submit your comments. Those are things that the task force will be taking a look at. So once we've done that, heard from the public, heard from community groups, heard from all the voices that really need to be part of this conversation, our task is to come up with recommendations as a task force that we will ultimately submit to the governor. And COVID-19 has delayed that a little bit. We're looking at the end of October to deliver those recommendations to the governor.
Amber, thanks for that. So my question is a hard one. It's fundamentally about priorities. And so just a little background information. So we know scientists have been warning the world about climate change for about 3 decades. And at least for the last 20 to 25 years, we've understood the parameters of the problem pretty well. Scientifically, we understand that. Since that time, I'd say most of the work has really been about just getting some of the local and regional details understood better, which certainly would be of greatest help to policymakers, but the big picture has been understood. One of the issue of priorities is that just as with a pandemic, delayed action makes the problem much, much worse because of the exponential growth process. So we know, for example, that even though this year greenhouse gas emissions because of the economic shutdown have fallen dramatically, our overall greenhouse gas concentrations are at their highest level in the last 3 to 5 million years. So it's not something that you can do just overnight. It takes concrete action over a long period of time. And unfortunately, unlike the pandemic, in which a timescale of basically 2 to 4 weeks seems to be too long for a lot of people, we're dealing with something that you're talking about having to undertake actions that are effective over many years. So the question is, how do you make effective policy changes in this environment? And for instance, what are the areas of common ground between political parties? You noted what happened under the Walker administration. Now we're seeing a big change, at least from a principled standpoint under the Evers administration, but how does that translate to action where you really need to get everybody on board?
So it's easy to sit down and talk about areas of common ground because there's lots of things that we need to do. But as somebody who sees the science and sees the long-term implications here, we know that the change that we need has to be bold. So it's really, I think, a challenge to kind of bridge that gap between what I might call like more the low-hanging fruit things that we honestly should have been doing 10 years ago that are probably more easy to get consensus on, and the bold action that we really need to make sure that we're protecting ourselves and our health. So I think that's playing out a lot through especially the public comments, which really people are coming at this and they understand the gravity. They're saying, me and my neighbors all have asthma. That can't be right. There's an environmental reason for that. And a lot of it has to do with air pollution and the impacts of things like climate change. Or I can't drink my water. There's just so many impacts that people are seeing there. People have talked about this internal anxiety that they're feeling. I hear this especially from younger generations that are really speaking up. They are concerned for their generation as to the world that they're going to inherit, so much so that it's causing them anxiety. I mean, can you imagine? I can imagine that because I deal with this every day, but it just makes me so sad that these young people have to spend so much time being worried about this when really we should have been doing this a long time ago. Governor Evers' executive order also lays out a goal of 100% clean energy by 2050. And that's really what we're trying to get to right now. I think it's a very doable goal, but we are going to need bold action to get us there and to get to where the scientists warn we're gonna start seeing more the major impacts of climate change.
Shalonda, did you want to jump in?
I was nodding vigorously to both of you, but I want to pick up on the piece that that Paul raised, which is one that I hear a lot, and that is, we have no time to lose, right? And how do we balance all of these competing interests? How do we balance a just process against the urgency in which we need to move to avert catastrophic climate change? So I know Paul is a scientist, and he's probably aware that there's already enough carbon dioxide in the atmosphere such that we're going to experience pretty devastating climate impacts, even if we stopped emitting tomorrow, right? So, the question of adaptation is kind of already becoming the one that we need to be dealing with. And I think we can do this transition, you know, in these two tracks, right? We can certainly bring more clean energy online, but as we do so, we need to be making the energy system itself more resilient. But we need an energy system that is itself nimble. And that may mean that the traditional players in the system go away or change roles. And so Amber, one of the things you mentioned was utilities and thinking about utility structure and whether or not we should be kind of relying on traditional investor-owned utilities in the same way, or they change roles and maybe are purely running the electricity through the lines, but all of our communities are kind of putting our energy in that system. And so in order to transition to that kind of new world, we do need courage and ambition, but we also, as you said, need some of that technology to facilitate new markets and new pathways for participation. But this new energy system has to be more nimble. And again, we have to do it in a way that doesn't leave the poorest people, the most marginalized, without access to medicines because they can't keep their houses, you know, cool. They can't keep the refrigerator on in a power outage. And we know that places like California are going to see that a lot more. We can't have folks going out to their rooftops like they did with Hurricane Katrina. And then this massive internal migration because of climate change. We have to figure out ways to make their communities resilient so that they can stay in place when the inevitable storms come, because they are coming, and the fires and the floods. I know it's dark, but we kind of have to face the reality that we're already down a pretty dark path.
If I could jump in there, Shalanda, so some of the comments you made kind of inspired me to get your reaction to this. And to my mind as a scientist, it's a pretty terrifying idea. Just to give you that perspective, that's how I feel about it. But because scientists have been watching relative inaction over many years, there are quite a number now that are advocating for geoengineering approaches to combating climate change. And so in a sense, they've given up on policy as being an effective solution in the short term, at least. And they view geoengineering as a way of buying time for us to get around to the fact of making these changes. So what's your perspective on that?
There's a word called hubris. I mean, we're in effect living through a massively geoengineered time, right? I mean, spewing fossil fuels or carbon dioxide into the atmosphere for the last couple hundred years plus is itself a huge geoengineering experiment, and we failed, right? I mean, I would have faith, well, I don't have faith in geoengineering. Let me just be very transparent, but there are a few reasons why I don't. And one is, if the very same players and power systems, power structures, and I'm talking about political power now and economic power, if they are the ones designing the geoengineering system, then it will certainly be designed to marginalize those who are already on the edge. And so I mentioned first and worst impacted. We have that sort of first and worst, we have those communities here in the United States, but we also have them globally. And in the global South, developing countries will most certainly be on the short end of that stick, because they will likely not be at the design table as those geoengineering experiments get underway. So that's one sort of moral and ethical concern I have with geoengineering. And then other is, I just don't trust that we know enough about the atmosphere and the complexity of our Earth systems to make it work. We can't even,
Let me just say I heartily second that.
Okay, yeah, I'm the lawyer. And then I don't know how you would govern it. I mean, we have an international system that is defunct, dysfunctional. You know, our president pulls out of agreements left and right, and we barely sign agreements here in this country. So we would need a system of international governance to manage geoengineering, and we don't have a good example of what that would look like. So for all those reasons, the moral, the science, and just lack of governance, I would say no.
You know, this gets to the heart of the part of the complexity, right? I mean, how do we get at those big, big, powerful forces that have guided our economies and our nations for so long? We're sort of at that point, action is critical.
I really think that where all of that starts is by people, by trying to lift people's voices and by having them be part of the conversation. You know, we have had these unfortunately polarized and partisan conversations in Wisconsin for far too long around climate change and energy. I think that when you start looking at stuff like that, that motivates politicians, say polling being one of those things, you can see a pretty stark difference when you start looking, especially at younger generations and how they feel about climate change and the action that they demand. And so you're going to start having real political problems if you're not, if you're going to keep sticking your head in the sand on climate change. It is not a sustainable position to say no. And I'm glad that we've moved away from that. So I think like a combination of people being more vocal. I mean, think about these wonderful youth movements in climate that we have seen just leading the way. It gets conversations started. It gets you seeing the spectrum of opportunity of where we could go, and that's a good thing. So just like getting outside of this partisan box is going to be really necessary. I will say the thing that has come up a lot with the task force lately is, well, we're going to be in, you know, recession, you know, huge economic impacts. We can't do anything that spends money. And I just have to say, I think that's such short-term thinking. No, for the reasons that I already outlined, these kind of solutions can be part of reinvigorating our economy. They can be job creators. They are huge job creators. Let's start thinking about this in a totally different way about how we transform our workforce and our communities to be part of, to take advantage of the clean energy economy that is here and that other states have really unfortunately been capturing in way more than Wisconsin has. We'll get there, but we do need to start moving fast.
Paul, are you in the mood for a closing comment or an observation? Where has this conversation taken you?
Well, I think it just reinforces in my mind how many opportunities do exist to change this story in a positive way instead of just continuing to drift in the direction that we have been. So there's things that we can do on many different fronts that would help make the future a lot less grim than it looks right now. And I think that's the big takeaway here. But we have to start doing it.
That was Amber Meyer-Smith from Clean Wisconsin. You also heard from Shalonda Baker, a professor of law, public policy, and urban affairs at Northeastern University School of Law, and Paul Rober, distinguished professor of atmospheric science at UW-Milwaukee. They spoke with WUWM's environmental reporter Susan Benz.